From WNAT in New York, hi, I'm Tom Stewart, and welcome to a special edition of WNAT Up Next. For this episode, we're going on the road to the Apollo Theater in New York City, where there was recently a special screening of The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. Now here's that discussion.
The Black Panthers.
Black Panther.
The Black Panthers were absolutely unique.
Police jump on you, beat you up. This is what we were going through on a daily basis.
Now we have voices that we're not going to turn the other cheek.
We want black power!
Stop brutalizing our community or we're going to drive these pigs out.
We don't hate nobody because of their color. We hate oppression.
We wanted the entire community to follow.
I'm Rafael Piroman, host of WNET's program Metro Focus. On behalf of WNET, home to PBS stations 13, WLIW 21, and NJTV, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon to explore Stanley Nelson's very powerful film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. We hope you tune in to 13 on February 16th at 9 p.m. to see the film in its entirety. You didn't see all of it. It's a lot of good stuff you missed. Now, I'd like to thank our partners today, the Apollo Theater, of course, Firelight Media, ITVS, and PBS. I'd also like to thank all our panelists for participating in today's discussion, which is being recorded and will be available on 13.org. Now, Stanley Nelson has had a long and productive relationship with PBS. In fact, he and I first worked together on a 13 project almost 25 years ago. He was already a genius back then. Some of his other more prestigious collaborations with PBS include such films as Freedom Riders and Freedom Summer, as well as his film Sweet Honey in the Rock, Raise Your Voice, which was part of 13th acclaimed series, American Masters. Stanley, good to be with you again. Now, this is the way the next 45 minutes are going to go. I will have a conversation with the panelists, but it's not going to be just me. We wanted community participation as much as possible, so we solicited questions from the community, and we got almost 150 questions online back. From those, we selected quite a number of them that reflect the general questions. That is, the questions that I will ask from the community were asked many times. In those emails. So that'll be the community engagement, and we hope a lot of you already are here to listen to your questions. So Stanley, let me start with you. As I said, this is an incredibly powerful film, as we all know. What moved you to make it in the first place, and how long did it take you to do it?
The film took about 7 years to make, and so we finished the film about a year ago and have been doing festivals and theater runs and stuff like that. Since then, I thought, 7 years ago that this was a story that most people didn't know or understand, that we had come to think of the Panthers in a very different way than the Panthers were even thought about at the time. And so I thought it was just a great story. And I thought it was so relevant. A little did I know that it would become even more relevant as it has in the last 2 years. But I also think, you've seen part of the film. As a filmmaker, there are other reasons for making a film. As Erica said, the Panthers had swagger. They were sexy. There are great interviews. There's great music. There's great footage. All of those, truthfully go into why a filmmaker decides to make any film.
Oh, by the way, I should mention that the film just won, just got the Image Award from the NAACP for Best Doc.
Right. Which I think this was on Friday, so 2 days ago we won the Image Award.
Oh, congratulations.
Which is amazing in and of itself that a film on the Black Panthers wins the NAACP Image Award. There's something funny about that.
Now, Stanley, in a recent interview you told my colleague Jack Ford, something that you just kind of touched on now, that it's difficult for those who were not around in the heyday of the Panthers to actually see them now as they were seen then. I think this goes to a question that we received online from Sarah from New York, who asks, how has the passage of time burnished or tarnished the image of the Black Panther Party, even among progressives and liberals? And what myth or misunderstandings did you intend to clear up in your film?
Well, you know, again, I think that the way, you see in the film, the Panthers are speaking over and over again, and the audience is 50%, 80%, 90% white, you know. And over time, the Panthers, in some minds, have been thought to be this kind of, you know, hate white people group, you know. And I think that it's very clear that's not who they were. But that was also one of the things that J. Edgar Hoover spelled out that he wanted to do, was to isolate the Panthers from the community. And I think in some ways over time, you know, in some ways for some people, he was successful in doing that. And the myths, I mean, there's so many, but I think, you know, in the piece of the film that you saw, you know, one, you know, how young the Panthers were. Yeah. I think that's, you know, just amazing. And then the fact that the Panthers were over 50% women by the early 70s. And then, you know, that J. Edgar Hoover set out to destroy the Panthers and documented it. You know, it's not a rumor. Those documents that we use in the film are FBI documents, so you see it.
Now, Eric, as we saw in the film, you were truly motivated to become a Black Panther, motivated enough to go across the country to become one. Now, obviously, the appeal, the allure of the Panthers is evident. In fact, I asked Kathleen where I can sign up as we were walking up here. But elaborate. Tell me your personal story. What motivated you so much?
Well, can I do one thing before I answer you?
Absolutely.
Would all of the members of the Black Panther Party please stand? Just stand where you are. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And before the curtain went up, Kathleen looked at me and she said, and I was feeling very touched. I always am at the point, Stanley, where I see Fred. And Kathleen asked, did you think that you would live through it? We didn't. Did we?
No.
No. So that's why I wanted all of you to stand. Can everybody give everybody a round of applause? It was the in answer to your question, what motivated me and what touched me about Fred, it's the same thing. It was love. It was love for people. It was love for humanity. It was wanting to see a change in the systems that step on and hold people in check. And it didn't matter to me almost where I would do that or how I would do it. I had not a clue of what I was driving across the country to, but it was a strong calling and I listened. And I was there through until 1981. And I was there through every up, down, and nook and cranny of this transitions of the party. Back to what motivated me, it was love for African American people and all of the people of the world who are, as is said many times in the film, oppressed. And now we have fancy terms for that, like intersectionality. Shit, it wasn't that. It was just that I could see that poor people, there was a bottom line oppression that poor of every kind faced. Growing up in Washington, D.C., this was very clear to me. The poverty was so illuminated by Capitol Hill in Southeast D.C., where I lived. So I wanted to see a change, and I knew it probably would not come in my lifetime. But still I went, and John Huggins was with me And the film doesn't talk about this, but John Huggins was assassinated in broad daylight on January 17, 1969 on the UCLA campus with my dear friend Bunchy Carter. So the COINTELPRO was very smart at what it did. It was heinous. It was, I want to use a term that's not very scientific, evil. But it did a good job of misdirecting, discrediting, and that famous word they used, neutralizing us. So I kept going because of that love, and I keep going now because of that love.
Kathleen, you went on to become one of the top women leaders, perhaps the top woman leader in the Black Panther. You went on to become one of the to become one of the top leaders of the Black Panthers, Secretary of Communications, spokesperson, many other titles. And within the group that made many of the important decisions, what brought you into the party in the first place?
I was in an organization called SNCC. I wanted to be in SNCC ever since I saw young Black girls in Georgia go down and protest against the denial of the right to vote. And I was in high school, and I wanted to do what they did. And eventually, I was a student at Barnard, and 2 weeks after Stokely Carmichael on that Meredith March call for Black Power, and I loved the line in the film, "All the scared niggas in Mississippi are dead." Okay, this was Stokely. Stokely was gorgeous, he was brilliant, and he called for Black Power. 2 weeks later, I was at the office of SNCC working for SNCC, which I'd been wanting to do since high school. So my job in SNCC involved creating a student conference to bring these student organizations who were activists from around the country down to Nashville to get on the Black Power page. We had just switched from this Freedom Now to Black Power. So we were planning this conference, and it was for the Easter weekend of 1967. And it was a freak snowfall on the East Coast. And so none of the speakers and writers and people we'd invited could get to Nashville, except Eldridge Cleaver, who came from San Francisco. So he came to the conference, which Fisk told us to get off the campus. We couldn't have it. We were in a little church. And Eldridge Cleaver came, and the people picked him up and brought him to this apartment where I was retyping the conference agenda. And he said, he saw me, it was love at first sight. I looked up and saw this man who's bigger than Muhammad Ali standing in the doorway with his he'd been out of prison for 3 months after 9 years, and he just looked very solid and kind of, well, I don't know what it was, but I looked back. And he kept pursuing me and asking me for stuff, and we spent maybe a week in Nashville with the conference, and I said, well, I've got to go back to Atlanta. Well, how are you guys going to get there? And I said, I don't know. Fred Brooks was going to take us, and he said, well, I have a car. And so Fred Brooks got his car, and we drove to Atlanta. And after about 2 days in Atlanta, we were madly in love. But he had to go back and be on parole in California. So we exchanged letters. I went to visit him in California, came back. Then Huey Newton was shot in November. And all the Panthers were in jail for Sacramento, most of them. Bobby was, Emory was, the ones who could do things. With Eldridge and four teenagers left. And he said, you gotta come out here and help us. So I flew out to California when we got tax returns and started helping to do something, because Huey was facing the gas chamber, the party was in jail. Eldridge was the only adult in the room, basically. So we got engaged, I was helping him, we got married. You know, the rest is history.
So, you know, go ahead and clap. Feel free to clap. You know, as Stanley said, one of the things most surprising to me in watching this film, there's a couple of things, the youth and the fact that 50% or more than 50% of the rank and file were women. We got a question on that and from Julian from New York, and he'd like us to respond. And he said this, please speak about the role of women in leadership on the Black Panther Party, and how they were essential in the development of the party's survival programs.
Well, I want to say something. Women are essential in the role of developing all Black resistance.
Let's start with Nanny in Jamaica, okay? I mean, this is our community. I get tired of people making the assumption that women in black communities are in the same position as women in other communities. We are less exploited and more important because of the way men are brutalized and segregated and stomped out. So, as in the NAACP, as in SNCC, as in all the church organizations and the churches, women were very important in the Black Panther Party. However, I will say these important women in the Black Panther Party were very, very pleased to see men stand up, take on the role of intelligent, powerful, responsible leadership. That's what we want to see. So, as we saw that, these men were getting cut down, shot, sent to prison, and the women had to actually fulfill their roles. So that's how it became 50%. And as one sister said, yeah, well, we ran all the programs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we didn't necessarily run these programs because we want credit as women leaders. Mm-hmm. We want to see change in the community, wanted to see transformation. We wanted to empower and to transform our lives with men and with our children.
Well, you know, I was alive back then, and part of some of the movement, not your movement, but part of the movement, and I remember that it was a struggle in many progressive organizations to overcome male dominance. Did you have, Erica, was it a struggle to overcome male dominance within the party?
Not any more so than in the world that I lived in before, during, and after the Black Panther Party. Well, I could make it more plain, if you like.
As plain as you want.
That we are who we are when we enter any room, join any organization, or become a part of anything. We live in a society that is male dominant. And the perspective, the lens through which we see the world is male. So what the women of the Black Panther Party were saying, we're going to look at this different. Our motto was survival pending revolution. Do we want to carry those old ideas of men and women into a new world? No, we don't. Of course, we didn't use terms like feminism at that time. We weren't allergic to what that meant. It just didn't seem to fit for where we were until third world, quote, women's feminism came to be. However, we were very adamant, no, we won't wait. I remember this. I told a whole bunch of men, no, I won't eat second. No, what? No, I won't just cook. I won't just raise the children. We're gonna do everything together. We call ourselves revolutionary. That was how we talked. Now, talking doesn't always translate to transformation, but at least we were having those conversations. And women really didn't have roles. I want to say that, and it's similar to what Kathleen was saying. We didn't have a role. We were it.
There wasn't a division of labor.
No, not really, because we had to step forward, and wherever we had to step forward, we did. And we met the challenges when we could, and where we could not change something, we just kept going. And we were then an inspiration. The women of the Black Panther Party were an inspiration to me. And when I look back, they still are. And when I look at the women who coined the term Black Lives Matter, I'm thinking, there we are again. Yeah.
David, you joined the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party in the spring of 69 when you were 16.
That's correct.
Did you stand out because of your youth, or were 16, 17, 18-year-olds common in the Illinois chapter of the Panthers, or in the Panthers in general, as it sounds like?
Well, look at me. There were several reasons I stood out, but... you know, I was the second youngest member of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. There was a brother that was 15 years old, and then there was me. And most of the people in the party were older teenagers. who, when you're 16, someone that's older or even someone 21 years old, is they're grown. I mean, we were, you know, you thought of yourself as a man-child. I mean, I was, as far as I was concerned, I was a man. You know, I was a grown man. I was doing grown man things. I was risking my life, which you know, when you in those days where you're very, very romantic about your mortality, Kathleen said to Erica earlier, did we ever imagine that we would live to see now? Of course not. I'd actually written an obituary for myself. You know, Brother David went down in this battle at the so-and-so. You know, I mean, that's what I was on, you know. So, you know, being as though most of the people in the party were younger, it wasn't particularly unusual. Now, as to the other thing about me that stood out, I do have a very quick and funny story about that. We went through a little period where we were supposed to be underground, and people in the party were not supposed to wear Black Panther paraphernalia. No, no berets, no leather jackets, no buttons. No, we used to wear 50 caliber bullets around our neck. I mean, we had a certain look. As you can see from the film, there was a Panther uniform of sorts. And for a period there, the Illinois chapter, okay, all you brothers and sisters, go underground. Don't wear Panther stuff. So is there anybody here other than my children from Chicago? Anybody here from Chicago? Okay, well, you're familiar with the west side of Chicago, right? So Panther headquarters is at 2350 West Madison, in the heart of the west side. In fact, during the riot, the insurrection after Dr. King's assassination, you saw the Madison Arms in flames. So the brothers and sisters on the west side did not play. That's where Panther headquarters was. So one day I was standing across the street from Panther headquarters, and at that time, Bobby Rush, who was the Minister of Defense of the Illinois chapter, saw me and some other Panthers across the street, and he said, brother, come here. So I go across the street, yes, comrade, you know. He said, brother, look, put his hand on my shoulder. When you go home tonight and get ready to come back tomorrow, put on all your stuff, brother. Put on your tam, your leather jacket, your bullet around your neck, put on everything you can, because brothers on the west side are gonna think you white. You know, that may not work out well. So I'm like, right on. So everybody else that have on their plain clothes Panther uniform, and I would have my uniform on. And it worked out well, you know. I still got some of it, too.
going back to the issue of the youth, and maybe both of you can chime in on this as well. How do you think, David, that the youth of the party's rank and file affected the trajectory of the party, its successes and its failures?
Well, again, because of youth, I mean, you can only know so much in X amount of time. We didn't necessarily have the benefit of elders, as it were. I mean, keep in mind that, you know, the Black Panther Party was not the first group of men and women to resist conditions. I mean, some Africans did not end up here because they took the heads of the oppressor when they walked through the village. So, that being said, I had to say that. That being said, our youth was an asset for the very reason the brother mentioned in the film, because we were young and because we were immersed in a culture of resistance. Remember, this was during the 60s. It was during SNCC. It was during seeing, you know, when I saw the brothers, as Michael McCarty said, when I saw the picture of Huey with the shotgun and everything, you know, I'm like, that's what I'm talking about, because when I heard Stokely Carmichael say Black Power, I was in seventh grade. I was politicized then because I liked the way that sounded. I didn't understand Dr. King's methodology because I didn't understand the idea of marching and having people throw rocks and sicking dogs on you. I wasn't mature enough to see the courage of what those people were doing, but in my observation, that just didn't seem like my methodology. And when I saw those brothers with those shotguns and those brothers staring down those pigs and intimidating them, you know, I mean, not to brutalize people, I said, oh yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So my youthfulness, And my enthusiasm for that, for resistance, for armed struggle and armed defense, is what really attracted me to the Black Panther Party.
Either one of you think the youth of the party had a significant effect on the trajectory of the party?
I couldn't hear you.
Do you think that the youth of the party had a significant effect on the trajectory of
the party? I think the most significant part of the youth is that youth that really do believe they are mortal. They know that people die, but they don't really believe that happens.
Yeah.
So, or they're willing to die because they don't really know what it means. So you have all these teenagers, die for the people, or they're going to put their, I mean, the energy was so phenomenal. It was so contagious. And looking at the pictures, people were just beautiful because they were young. They were young, they lived in California, it was sunny, it was the Vietnam War, people were dying, and the Vietnam War is actually central to the explosion of the Black Panther Party because they started drafting a lot of young black men that they didn't do that before, and they changed the standards, and they would wipe out whole high schools of young black men if they were willing to sign up or if they were drafted. And so this attitude became, well, if I have to die, why do I have to go all the way to Vietnam? I might as well stay here and fight. And so this attitude of fighting, and the Vietnamese were not being defeated. That's the other central part of the Vietnam story that's important to the Panthers. Malcolm X called them the little yellow men in black pajamas. Look, if they can do this, they can take on Sam. What can you do? So there was an attitude that we were empowered to fight and defend and to challenge this oppression because the United States was not winning the war in Vietnam, and there were countries all over the world that were unwilling to support the United States because they were against what was happening in Vietnam, including the French, who had attempted to win in Vietnam and had lost. And so the combination of seeing young freedom fighters in Africa and young freedom fighters in Vietnam, we wanted to be freedom fighters, and I think being young is really a very significant part of that.
Can I just add something here? Because I see that there's a lot of young people here, and I think one of the things that's also important is that, you know, revolution is always made by young people.
Yes.
As far as I know, there's never been an old folks revolution in the history of the world. Okay. So, you know, revolution is made by young people, so remember that.
Well, Stanley, I'm glad you said that because I was thinking about what would make my heart sing, especially when I was incarcerated, that there were young people out there yelling for not just my freedom or Bobby Seale's freedom, but for the freedom of people incarcerated or in carceral sites all over the globe. And war is a carceral site. And we were brave. That's how I want to answer your question. We were so brave because we didn't know what the future held. And there was a way in which we told ourselves we didn't care. We just had to do this. There were people who came because it was cute or we were cute or something.
You're
but that
cute.
Is not what that is not why we stayed. That is not what we were doing. It was not romantic at all. And again, when I was incarcerated, it was my youth that kept me resilient. I refused to go out like that. And I talked as best I could, because my words were contraband in prison, to the women incarcerated with me. I will never forget them. There's no way you can leave and leave the people who are still there. My point is that I talked to them about true freedom, which is internal, starts there. And then it goes out. It doesn't come from here and go in. And so they could hear it because they were young. And so a whole subculture formed in that prison. And So Stanley's right. It was that the bravery of youth, the conscientiousness of youth, the open-mindedness, and the sometimes lightheartedness. We laughed all the time because otherwise we would fold. So it's a great question about young people, and I am so inspired. I can't see you because the lights are strange, but I'm so inspired by young people. You should know that we have your back.
You wanted to add something, Kathleen?
Yes, I wanted to point out that at least in Oakland, and I'm sure in other cities, but I knew what was going on in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and Oakland, there were very mature, serious, older people. I'm thinking of Ruth Hagwood in Oakland, and there was Father Neil, who was an Episcopal priest.
What a heart.
Who had our back. They came to all our meetings. They worked with us. They weren't members. They were our support system. And I think at one point, Bobby made them into an advisory committee, but these were people who came because of the same appeal that the young people had for us. They appealed to them. Yeah. I think Maya Angelou was in that group in San Francisco. And this happens. It's because our community, the mature people will see something that's very positive that young people are doing and understand how frail young people are and how little they know, and so they kind of just move in to help them, and they're always there. So that, I mean, it was young people with the help of
some sage advice,
the adults who supported them.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Jamila, you grew up in a Black Panther family. David's your father. You were a Panther cub, as they say. How did that Black Panther inheritance inform your political views or your views of the world in general?
Well, certainly my father, you've experienced, he's a dynamic speaker. He's a wealth of knowledge and information, and he loves to talk. So there was no shortage of stories about the party in my childhood and throughout my young adulthood. My values and who I am as a woman, as a thinker, as a journalist, as a mother, have certainly been impacted and shaped by the experiences that he had as a member of the Black Panther Party and the wisdom that he was able to pass on to me and to my two sisters. And also, I was inspired to study revolutionaries. I was inspired to learn more about the party and other organizations and some of the leaders, some of the things that had been done to our people because I had him in the household. I'm 31. My father was 16 when he joined the party, so I'm one of the youngest of the children, even though men can have children for a very long time. I would still wager that I'm one of the youngest of the Panther Cubs out there. So I would certainly, my experiences are different than somebody who had that was born while their parents were still in the party. But having him as a father did set me apart from a lot of my peers and classmates who'd had parents that had just kind of missed that moment in time altogether, it seems, that had really gotten invested in, what they saw as the possibilities of capitalism and, class attainment. And so I came to the table saying certain things that other kids weren't getting at home. And so it's really cool to see that now folks are like, all that stuff you were saying when we were in high school might not have been the craziest thing ever. And maybe you had a point.
And speaking about your peers, how knowledgeable do you think, this is going back to a question I asked Stanley, how knowledgeable do you think they are, your contemporary activists, to the reality rather than the myth of the Black Panthers?
I would say that people in my peer group who consider themselves to be activists, some of them are extremely knowledgeable about the party, have taken time, which I think is incredibly important, to actually get to know members of the party. I mean, look at this stage. Look at the audience. People are still here, right? So you don't have to go to a textbook that has been edited by a university to get your introduction to the Black Panther Party. It's not to say that can't be a resource. But that you should consult with people who've lived this history that you claim to lean on. So there are a lot of young activists that I think are relatively well-versed in, interested in the movements of the Panthers, what worked, what didn't work, how they can build on that legacy without offending it, without being disrespectful and saying we're so much better, we know so much more now, and also not just saying, let's just do exactly what they did. Like, I printed out the 10-point program, we're just gonna do this, because this is exactly what we should do. That's probably not what you should do right now. There are, I would say, amongst those that don't consider themselves to be activists, however, we barely talked about the Black Panthers in elementary and high school. You know, unless you took elective level classes in high school in particular, where you said, okay, I want to take an African American studies class, and you had the good fortune to get a teacher that knew. So I attended college at Howard University, and I was surprised. I've been surprised throughout my academic history how many people just did not know things about the Black Panther Party. And I think the difference, in certain circles at least, between white ignorance about the Black Panther Party and Black ignorance is that, at the very least, most Black folks that I come across, I'm sure you all's experiences have been different, have a generally favorable view of the party. Maybe just a completely, totally romantic, yeah, Black Power, that was cool, that was cool, I like that, you know? It's not so much like, oh, they were just, no, you know, the way that I've heard older people talk about the party. But there's still such a lack of knowing, which is why I was so happy that this film was happening and to be able to support it.
So let's turn to the Panther legacy and the lessons that can be learned from the Panther legacy. And let me start with a question from Lisa Marie from West Orange. She asks, what is the most significant thing you feel the Panthers accomplished and the most important thing they left undone? Let me start with you, brother.
Well, sort of my personal passion for all the service work that the party did, which was awesome. Breakfast for Children programs, sickle cell anemia testing. There were free bus rides to visit incarcerated men and women in prison. I mean, I can tell you about the things that the Illinois chapter did. We had a free health clinic for people. For all of that, we also advocated, this is mine, remember, I'm not speaking for the Black Panther Party, I'm speaking from my experience. We believed in armed self-defense. That's like a big deal to me, because what that's saying is, you can't just do anything you want to me just because. I will fight you back.
You want to? The most significant accomplishments and what was left undone?
Well, let's go to the accomplishment. We took the initiative. We didn't wait for someone else to say, well, maybe you ought to do this. No, we said, this is it. This is what we're going to do. Let's go.
That's right.
And that has something to do with how we were brought up and the communities we were part of, what kind of parenting we had. And the fact, well, in my case, my parents had been activists, and they had worked in NAACP campaigns and had worked in desegregation campaigns, et cetera. In fact, they were kind of intimidated when I got in. They said, you're going to be used. You're going to be this. But they really didn't ever try and stop me. So there's always hassles and problems when people challenge the government, stand up against the government. I think my father had some professional problems, because by the time I became a Black Panther, he was working for the United States State Department. However, I came across a record that said, the FBI record, oh, we have discovered that Ernest E. Neal is an employee of the United States State Department. He is the father of Kathleen Neal. And so I think maybe they kind of backed off. I think that may have been beneficial. I don't know. But anyway, if something had happened to me, he would have been concerned. So what I think is to take the initiative, to organize, to trust the people, to trust the talents and instincts, and you can benefit. You can have that kind of organization. Now, we were a little bit too trusting, because we had all kinds of other people coming in to infiltrate and destroy us. So maybe you should be a little bit more intelligent on that level. But that's a legacy. Do it. Just go out and make a change, see a problem, work to solve it, get other people, think for yourself, go and raise money, start it. Get it started, and people will come to you. I think that's our legacy.
Erica?
And what's undone is all of that. By that I mean that I'm thinking now, as you both were speaking, I'm thinking about the Oakland Community School, which was a model elementary school created by the Black Panther Party. You see, all of the community survival programs, we didn't say, what do black folks need? Well, let's give them this. No, that had already been done. We went to people and said, what do you need? Sickle cell anemia testing, free clinics, busing to prisons programs, pest control, coat giveaways on the East Coast, shoe giveaways on the West Coast. There were, I'm limited with time, so I can't list all of the survival programs, but the Oakland Community School was the longest standing and most phenomenal place where students could attend. It was student-centered, community-based, tuition-free, and all families were welcome. And to Kathleen's point about we didn't wait for people to do it, we knew that education, public education, was a dinosaur, still is. Yeah. Yeah. It was based on warehousing children in another century. And so we took it upon ourselves with alliance with the Oakland Unified and Berkeley Unified and San Francisco Unified School Districts. I don't mean those districts, but great people in them. We formed coalitions, and so that school is an example of something that can be done on a shoestring. None of us collected a paycheck in the first few years of that school.
All right, the time is running out faster than I'd hoped, so let me move on with some of these questions that I definitely want to ask. And Stanley, maybe I'll start with you on this one.
And will the audience engage us?
Well, that's why we had the
the action. All right.
So Stanley, what parallels and differences do you see between the Black Panthers and the Black Lives Matter movement, and what do you think that today's Black Lives Matter movement can learn from the Black Panthers, from your seven years of work?
Well, you know, I think that also goes back to the last question. I think, you know, one of the things that the Black Panthers are is they're an inspiration. You know, they're not a model. You know, we're not saying that who the Panthers were 50 years ago is the model for today, but I think the Panthers are an inspiration. You know, one thing that always strikes me early on in the film, Big Man Howard is talking, and there's a picture of, you know, Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, Big Man, Little Bobby Hutton, and the Forte brothers, and they're all standing there outside in a yard, and that's the Black Panther Party at that point. It's those six guys who decided that enough with the police brutality in Oakland. And here we are, 50 years later, still talking about the Panthers. So I think that, you know, as the Panthers are, should be an inspiration for people today of what you can do, you know, yourselves and how to get involved and make things happen.
David, this is a question from Karen from New York. She asked, what are the lessons that today activists can learn from the destruction of the party? What can activists learn to strengthen their work from those lessons?
I'll make it as brief as I can. I want everybody to remember that America was founded on the genocide of the people who lived here and the enslavement of the African. It's founded on that. I mean, I'm talking about all your public services, your governmental services, everything. This country was founded on that. That's the actual government of the United States, the actual government. It is the same government. That being said, and understanding the heinous behavior that they've historically, which was like right now, is going on, understanding their heinous behavior in the past and today, you must be very careful how you comport yourself and those things that you're going to do that are most dangerous. The things that are most dangerous, you don't need to talk about them with everybody, okay? You don't need to tell, you know, if your methodology is one that you know will place you, your loved ones, and everyone else in serious physical danger, I'm not telling you to abandon your methodology. I'm saying be cautious with it. You cannot sell wolf tickets to these people. Okay, these are the same people that wrote letters to Dr. King's wife to try to dismantle his family. okay? These are the people that helped assassinate Malcolm X. These are the people that helped assassinate the brothers on the UCLA campus. These are the same brothers the same people that assassinated Fred Hampton and Mark Clark and Larry Robeson and Jake Winters and Babatunde Omawale. See, their picture is not on a poster, but there are a lot of us who've been killed through the insidious mechanics of this government. And you can't at any time lose sight of what you're dealing with. So what you can learn from the party, tread carefully. Don't sell wolf tickets if you can't back them up. And you know what? Don't even sell them. Just do.
Erica, this question from Ra from New York. He asks, what do you feel is the role of black music and black art as a whole in continuing the legacy of revolution championed by the Black Panther Party?
Well, I'm sure that some people in this great place know this, but, the Black Panther Party and what we used to call the Black Arts Movement were like this. You would be surprised, maybe not, that Tarika Lewis, who you saw on screen talking about being the first woman to join the Black Panther Party, was a violinist, and she dropped it. And she joined the Black Panther Party. There were poets and artists, Emory, incredible artists. But what he said was not art for the people's sake, not art for art's sake, art for the people's sake. And so I feel that today, the coalitions that we formed, if it is possible that artists and activists can work together. And we did then, and we would not have had a movement without all of the artists that supported us and that were within our Black Panther Party and throughout the movements all over the globe, but definitely in the United States.
All right. Thank you. And finally, Stanley, this one from Mark from New York. How do you hope the film will contribute to the national discourse? How do you hope it will help activists deal with some of the same issues that unfortunately continue today?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to say thank you all so much for contributing to the film.
Thank you.
I'm trying not to get teared up. It's been a wild ride. It's been incredible. And I just also want to thank everybody who worked on the film. Lorenz, could please stand up. Lorenz Grant, Nicole, anybody else that worked on the film. I just want to say thank you all so much for your crazy hard work on this project. I forgot what the question was.
The question is, how do you hope the film will contribute to the national discourse? How do you hope it will help activists deal with some of the same issues that gave birth to the Panthers in the first
place? I hope it'll be inspiring. I hope that people see the youth of the Panthers and be inspired. I hope they'll see the gender balance of the Panthers and be inspired. I hope they'll understand the threat forces from without. One of the things you didn't see was, how the FBI continues to hound the Panthers and really continues to affect the Panthers. And I think it's important that organizations and people now understand that they have to have ways to deal with that and those things in place so they can't be torn apart by forces from without.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for the panel discussion. I've been asked to remind you to complete the audience survey and to tweet about the broadcast on Tuesday, February 16th. We will pick winners from among those who tweet at random, and they will receive signed film posters. The winners will be notified via direct message on Twitter and email. My thanks again to this unbelievable panel.
Can I just add something real quick?
Yeah.
I just want to say again, everybody, February 16th is the premiere of the film on PBS, and that's national. Please let people know. Everybody now has a network, and please let your network know. We started out with the theatrical distribution going to 8 cities. We ended up in something like 150, 160 markets with this film, and that's with no money and no advertising. People just told other people. That is a power that we have. We can do it yourself. That's the power that the Panthers had. So let people know, let your network know. February 16th, all over the country, the film will be on. All power to the people.
Stanley, thank you so much for the film. Thank you for your fellow workers. A standing ovation for this panel, please.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of WNET Up Next, featuring filmmaker Stanley Nelson and others in a discussion of the Black Panthers, vanguard of the revolution. We'd love to hear your questions and comments at upnext@wnet.org. WNET Up Next is a presentation of the Design and On-Air Promotion Department of WNET New York. I'm Tom Stewart.